and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, September 1st, 2023. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. On the show, Rabble labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga sits down with Laura Sullivan, a spokesperson from On to Ottawa. On to Ottawa is calling on the government to implement a national firefighting agency that trains and employs 50,000 firefighters and legally binding citizens' assemblies to address the climate crisis. On to Ottawa is in the midst of its first action phase, disrupting traffic to call for action on these demands. Sullivan has been with On to Ottawa since its creation early this year. She's been arrested twice for painting Woolly the Mammoth, a statue in the Royal BC Museum, and painting the iconic Toronto sign in Nathan Phillips Square to draw attention to the On to Ottawa campaign. Here are Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga and Laura Sullivan in conversation. Take a listen.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Rabble Radio, Laura. Just to get started, could you tell me a bit about yourself and On to Ottawa?
Yeah, sure. My name is Laura. I'm a spokesperson for On to Ottawa. And On to Ottawa is a group of ordinary Canadians who are engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience in the nation's capital time after time after time to demand that the government implement a national firefighting agency that trains and employs 50,000 firefighters. And we're also demanding that the government enact citizens' assemblies to tackle the climate and ecological crisis in the next 2 years. We're fighting for this firefighter demand because so much of this country right now is on fire. The Northwest Territories are on fire. BC is on fire. There's states of emergencies across the country. People are losing their homes, their livelihoods. 4 firefighters have died so far this year, fighting on the front lines of the climate crisis. And Indigenous communities, especially in smaller communities up north and in BC, are the ones who are suffering the most. So obviously it's a climate issue and it's a social issue. It's all encompassing. And we're seeing our government not even being able to handle these very first national impacts of the climate crisis, which is terrifying. So we have to engage in civil resistance so that we can get our government to listen to this emergency demand.
And how did the organization get started?
The organization was started a few months ago. So it's just a group of ordinary people who've gotten together, who've decided we're really, really concerned about the way that the future is going. We're reading the science. We're seeing that our planet is just going towards climate and ecological breakdown. And we know that we're headed towards societal collapse if we don't do something. And obviously so much of the rest of the world's already suffering these impacts of the climate crisis, and our country is starting to see those same ones. So we know that everything that we've done so far in terms of campaigning has completely failed. We've been signing petitions, talking to our MPs, talking to MLAs, and none of that has worked because our emissions have only increased by 90% since 1970. So we know that we need to engage in civil disobedience to get the government to hear our demands, because this is truly our last chance at survival.
I'm curious about one of your demands. You talked about the demand for a national firefighting agency. So can you tell me a bit more about why call for that? What's going on right now and what could be improved?
Right. So obviously the firefighters that are out there are working so, so hard to really protect people, and they're doing their absolute best, but they just don't have enough support. So the fire chiefs of Canada have been calling on more firefighters. Right now, 70% of our firefighter force is volunteer-based, right? And that should not be the reality when people are putting their lives on the line. As well, provinces individually have been defunding their wildfire fighting forces. Ontario specifically defunded its wildfire fighting force by 67% in 2019. And the funds have never recovered. And this is absolutely unacceptable when this year's wildfire season is like the last 5 or 10 wildfire seasons combined. We truly are seeing an exponential escalation in the amount of fires, the intensity of fires, the devastating impacts of these fires. Smoke is obviously boundaryless. So it's really a national problem at this point, and the government needs to act like it is a national problem and not just push it off to the provinces. So we are demanding that this national firefighting agency train and employ 50,000 firefighters at the bare minimum. We really do need a strong force of people who are trained and have the proper funding to go out there and, you know, of course, fight these fires, but also for the beginning of next fire season, mitigate them before they get this bad and this out of control.
And that's shocking, the amount that we're relying on volunteer firefighters to go out and risk their lives right now. I'm wondering, have you done any research into kind of what the effect is on the people on the front lines who are fighting these fires to, you know, go out there either unpaid or underfunded?
Yeah, what a great question. Yeah, we've seen 4 young firefighters die this season. And of course, there's lots of media of these people's families speaking out about how they really need more support. I saw one sister of someone who's unfortunately passed away in Revelstoke fighting fires this season. And she was saying that what is it going to take for people to wake up to the realities of this climate crisis? Is it going to take more friends and family dying? Because that is the future that we're absolutely racing towards, right? If we don't take action on this crisis right now, then we're just going to be seeing more and more and more deaths. But as for these people who are working on the front lines, I can obviously imagine and extend my sympathies towards them, because it must be absolutely traumatic to, you know, be risking your life out there, but also to be seeing maybe some of your friends or colleagues go down with in these blazes. It doesn't have to be this way. The government could be supporting them way more. And, you know, the government will come out and make these statements of wishes and support for these people who have lost their family members, but we don't see any real action. And that's really devastating.
And so what would it mean for these people on the front lines to actually to be employed and have this funding?
Well, I think that what this would really mean is just they have more training, more support, more firefighters. Of course, you know, as our organization, we don't pretend to be experts. We know that the national fire chiefs, they know what they're doing. They just need more funding and more support and more personnel. So that's just what we're calling on the Canadian government to implement. And we know that they can, with the government's funding and personnel support, that, you know, these fire chiefs can really push people forward and get the job done.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. It's important to listen to the people on the front lines, for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess since you guys are an organization of ordinary people, as you said, what does it mean, like, for people who are actually affected by these wildfires to have, like, a volunteer or underfunded firefighting service in the face of this crisis?
I can only imagine that. And I mean, I've talked to people personally and have anecdotes, and we read articles and all of that. But I mean, it's obviously for them, it must be quite disheartening to be fighting these absolutely massive fires, some of them which might burn all winter long under the ground, and just not be getting the support they need, even though 55,000 people are not able to live where they are currently living right now in this country.
I'm curious about, you mentioned you've heard some anecdotes as well. Are you willing to share those, just like what you've been hearing from people on the ground?
Yeah, you know, I have a few friends who are firefighting right now, and you know, they're working really hard. And yeah, one of my friends, I won't name her name, just because I don't have the consent of that for right now for this interview. But yeah, she told me that the Donnie Creek wildfire that she's fighting up there is going to burn all winter long, and it's so massive, and they just don't have the supports to fully fight that fire, which I thought was absolutely terrifying to hear.
So can you tell me a bit more about the organizing you guys are doing? Like, what actions have you been taking? What kind of events have you been organizing then in response to this, as we've covered, very dire situation?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So we engage in nonviolent civil disobedience. And what that means is we will disrupt business as usual day after day, week after week, until we get our demand met. So right now we're in the middle of week one of our first action phase ever. So this week so far, we have had 2 roadblocks. We had 1 roadblock on Monday in downtown Ottawa. We had 4 people sitting on the road peacefully, nonviolently, and we had 3 of those people ended up getting arrested for blocking traffic, disrupting business as usual to get our demands heard. And then on Wednesday, we had 9 people block the road, and we had 6 of those people get arrested. And the first action was on Plaza Bridge in Ottawa, and the second action was on the Laurier Avenue Bridge. And, you know, we obviously are sorry that we have to disrupt people's commute to work. We know that that must be frustrating, but what's more damaging or what's more disruptive, us blocking you on your way to work or these fires that are ravaging people's homes right now? And we've reached a point where we just have to disrupt to be heard. And we're not doing this because we feel like it. We're doing this because we're looking at actual research that shows us that civil disobedience and nonviolent direct action is the fastest way to get the transformational change that is absolutely required for us to survive as a species going forward. And this is based on a lot of research and a lot of what's been working internationally right now. So that's why we use the strategy of blocking roads and disrupting traffic. It gets us the media attention that we need. And from this media attention, we will continue our action phase. Today, we're having a slow march starting at 5:30 p.m. from Confederation Park. And then from here, we'll be having 2 more weeks of disruptive action happening in Ottawa, building and building our media attention, the reach of our organization, so people can truly understand how serious the situation is. And from there, we will go into a recruitment phase and get more people on board, and we'll come back, and then we'll disrupt more. And we will keep iterating and keep doing this until we reach a critical mass, to which the point the government cannot ignore us anymore, because really people's lives are on the line here. Right? I mean, we've been told by ex-chief scientific advisor to the UK government, Sir David King, he said in 2021 that we have 3 to 4 years left to save humanity. And at this point, it's 2023, it's August 24th, and we now have less than 2 years left to save humanity. That's absolutely terrifying. And we have to do something about it. And, you know, as I said, we've tried every other form of disruption. This is the only thing that is left for us to do, is to get in the way of everyone's day-to-day lives. And we're really calling out to the public, pick a side.
I'm curious as well. I was looking on your website. I saw there were weekly talks going on, or introduction talks. Could you tell me a bit more about what that is and what you guys cover in those talks?
So we have introductory talks that happen on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. And essentially those are happening in Ottawa during this action phase. And they're typically held at St. Peter's Lutheran Church. The people of the church have been super nice to just let us use their space to give these talks. And what we typically talk about there is we spend a bit of time talking about the climate science and, you know, not just figures and facts. We all know we're in a crisis at this point, but really, what do those implications mean for us? What does it mean for me or for you on a day-to-day basis? What does 10 years down the line look like realistically for us based on science? And then from there, we go into talking about nonviolent direct action and why it works. We go through historical examples. We talk about more recent examples across Canada and across internationally over this crisis. And then we obviously talk about our plan onto Ottawa and how people can get involved. So really what these talks are is it's a space for people to come and learn more about our movement and why are we getting in the road time after time and disrupting traffic and, I mean, throwing paint at things. Why are we doing these actions where we know that we'll be arrested and tried and potentially go to jail or do prison time? And it's because of, obviously, this crisis is so pressing that these sacrifices seem small in comparison to what other people are already losing at this point. And then moreover, because it works and why it works. So those are our intro talks happening in person. I mean, if people are listening to this podcast or this radio show, sorry, from a distance and want to get involved, we also have online talks happening on Thursdays and Sundays, I believe. And then we also will have in Ottawa general assemblies that happen every Sunday. And now these general assemblies are spaces for people to come and get a nonviolent direct action training. So what that means is we actually train people before they go on the road so that they can remain nonviolent no matter what actually happens to them out there. Because we know that as we escalate our actions and as we become more disruptive, we are going to be facing increasing amounts of violence from both the public and potentially the police. And it is in our core values and nature to remain completely nonviolent. Throughout all of that, all we can do is show our utmost respect for everyone around us, because we are simply just calling on action from the government on this crisis that is going to kill us.
I'm curious, you mentioned in those talks, you kind of bring it down to like a level that people can really relate to in terms of the climate crisis. You talk about like how it'll affect everyone like in the next few years. Can you tell me a bit more about what you tell people? What's something like mundane almost that might be affected that people can really like grasp and understand?
We are basically sharing the facts that essentially the situation right now is that 1% of our Earth's surface is too hot to live on. It's like desert, uninhabitable. It's about 30 degrees surface temperature. It's just uninhabitable. You can't grow food. You can't live there. It's like the Sahara Desert. So that's right now at about 1.2, 1.3 degrees of pre-industrial, above pre-industrial temperatures. So at 2 degrees of warming, which is as soon as 11 years away, that 1% grows to 20%. So at that point, at 2 degrees of warming, 20% of our Earth's surface is going to be too hot for people to live on. People can't grow food. People can't exist there. It's just not going to work. What that means is a lot of Central America, parts of South America, parts of Africa, parts of the Middle East, in Asia, Southern Europe, Southern United States, these places are going to be uninhabitable. And what that means is that 1 billion people will not be able to live where they are currently living within the next 10 years, within most of our lifetimes. And what does that actually mean for people who are living up north, up here in Canada? That means 1 billion people are going to be on the move as refugees. And we know that our world does not handle refugee crises very well, right? And no one really wants to be honest. The media doesn't want to be honest with everyday people about what that actually looks like. And we can project what that's actually going to look like because we know what happened during the Syrian refugee crisis, right? During the Syrian refugee crisis, we had about 5 million people who were displaced and something like 500,000 of those people were killed, maybe even more. So if we want to project that onto this refugee crisis that's about to happen and it's already underway, that's like 100 million deaths in our lifetime. That's like unfathomable. So what we are doing right now is we are trying to organize peacefully and nonviolently so we can actually handle the impacts of the climate crisis in an equitable way and also mitigate those impacts of the climate crisis so that we don't end up in these situations that are going to kill so many of us. So I think that for people, it's about time to just wake up and realize that what you're dreaming of in the next 10 years, if you're working in your career, you know, if you've got kids that you want to have a future for, if you, you know, working on your creative pursuits or have big dreams to happen in 10 years, none of this is going to happen. The future simply does not exist unless we fight for it. So if anyone here is listening today, what I'm really doing is I'm calling you out to join our organization, to get on the streets with us and to resist and organize together so that we have an actual chance at survival.
And I really like kind of what you're mentioning about like organizing, giving us a chance, because I think there's a lot of people in the face of this climate crisis that are feeling a sense of hopelessness, which is understandable. But there is, I guess, as you kind of say, there is hope.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't think that the hope lies in sitting around and hoping for the best, right? I think that the hope lies within organizing with each other and doing so in a logical and rational way. And I think that hope is really thinking that humanity is better than to give into extinction. And I understand when people are hopeless and I understand that people might feel, you know, like there's no point in trying, but we have a short window of opportunity. And we know and we've seen throughout history how humans can come together, organize effectively, peacefully, and nonviolently, and put aside their differences. And I know that there is the potential for us to do this under the greatest threat that humanity has ever faced. So, you know, of course, what's happening across the world right now is absolutely devastating. It's terrifying. It's horrible. But if there's a time to act, it's right now. And even though for some people it might not feel like it's the most important thing in their lives, I understand people are struggling with the cost of living. People have so many other, you know, issues that are a result of our extraction-based society. But we have to solve this one first because this is truly the end of the world. So this is the most important thing right now.
Just before we end this interview, is there anything else you wanted to add or mention?
The only thing that I would say is that, you know, if anyone's listening and they want to get involved, we are open arms and, yeah, come to a talk, come to a general assembly. If you're in Ottawa, join us in Slow March. Yeah. You know, we're really calling out on people who want to have a future and who are interested in reaching for that. Come join us. You know, we of course need people to be getting out there and getting arrested. But if that's not a possibility for you, there's still lots of ways that you can help. And if you can't get involved, then we really, really need donations. So if anyone's listening and wants to donate or has something that they can give, we have our website is www.on2ottawa.ca, and you can find our donation link on our website. We're also on all social medias, so that's at on2ottawa on Instagram and Twitter as well, and Facebook as well. So yeah, thanks.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Laura.
Yeah, thanks so much, Gabby. It's been really awesome to speak with you.
Rabble Labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga and Laura Sullivan, a spokesperson from On to Ottawa, in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Laura and Gabby. Switching gears now, here's Rabble editor Nick Seabrook to catch us up on the top news stories of the week in a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week, Ontario Education Minister Stephen Lecce voiced his support for harmful and discriminatory policies targeting trans youths in schools. At a news conference on Monday, Lecce signaled his approval of anti-trans policies that require students to obtain parental permission for pronoun or name changes. Such policies have been adopted in New Brunswick and Saskatchewan this summer. Faye Johnstone, president of Momentum, a nonprofit focused on 2S LGBTQI+ advocacy, pointed out the dangers such policies posed, writing, quote, "Mandating parental consent for trans students will harm the most vulnerable trans kids, those without supportive parents. We should be asking, who is pushing for these changes? Because it's not parents," end quote. In labor news, Manitoba long-term care continues to fall into a deeper crisis. According to a new report by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, staffing and labour condition issues persist despite high risk to patients. Many care workers tend to be precariously employed. The report found that 49% of workers in long-term care facilities are employed on a part-time basis or a casual basis. Meanwhile, a whopping 59% of home care workers are part-time or casual. Care workers are paid below the provincial median, according to the report. Hourly wages sit at between $18.87 and $21.04 an hour, while the Manitoba median hourly wage is $24. At this rate of pay, only 15% of long-term care workers and 10% of home care workers feel their job allows them to save for the future. Cutting costs by cutting staff has proven deadly in some long-term care facilities as seen during the COVID-19 pandemic. When care is put above profit, lives can be saved. In other labor news, public education workers in Ontario have raised alarms on the upcoming school year regarding adequate funding, increased violence in schools, and support for student and faculty mental health services. According to research done by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, funding per student in the 2023-2024 school year will be less than $1,200 than in the 2018-2019 school year. This is a result of inflation rising by 17.3% since 2018, while funding for schools only rose 6.8%. Multiple education unions are currently in the midst of contract negotiations with the provincial government. The Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario, the Ontario English Catholic Teachers Association, the Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation, and the Union for Teachers in the French School System, l'Association des Enseignants et des Enseignants Franco-Ontariens, are all in the midst of bargaining for their next collective agreement with the Government of Ontario. In environmental news, Rabble Assistant Editor Georgia Kelly analyzes the criticism of China's environmental record, as well as the Canadian government's decision to send Environment Minister Stephen Guilbeault to an environmental summit in Beijing this past weekend. Conservative MPs accuse Guilbeault of ignoring human rights abuses and alleged attacks by China on Canada's democracy. China is the country that emits the most carbon by volume, and shunning it won't likely change that. Canada is also a major carbon emitter. In fact, Canada's emissions, when measured by per capita, are 3 times higher than those of China. And finally, are you a journalist at the beginning of your career with a passion for social justice? Rabble is now accepting applications for the 2023-2024 Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellowship. This 4-month-long fellowship supports emerging Canadian journalists who are enthusiastic about social justice forward reporting. To apply, please send a cover letter indicating why you should be the Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellow together with your resume, feature pitch, and 2 writing samples to internships@rabble.ca. Your feature pitch should be a story you would like to develop during your time as a fellow and must be centered in social justice. Here's a message from Kia Lucero, our Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellow from last year.
My name is Kia Lucero, and I'm the Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellow for winter of 2022 to 2023. Going through this fellowship allowed me to find out who I wanted to be as a journalist while looking introspectively at how to fulfill this role with compassion and honesty. Working on my feature piece, I was able to dive deeper into the complexities of the Temporary Foreign Worker Program. Rabble opened up the space for me to investigate the inadequacies and oppression of the system. The Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellowship is for anybody who is passionate about social justice, dismantling systemic oppression, and finding solutions. I encourage anybody who is passionate about any of these things to apply.
For more details on your application and your time as a fellow, please visit rabble.ca/journalismforchange. Please note, entries close September 22nd at midnight. As always, you can find the full version of these stories and much, much more on rabble.ca.
Rabble.ca shares news for the rest of us. We believe news for the rest of us is about creating a more informed and connected world. Help rabble.ca make quality, progressive news and views accessible to all. Become a Rabble Rouser today and support us during our summer fundraiser with a one-time or monthly donation.
That's it for Rabble Radio this week. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.